Good afternoon, everyone. Today it's the Senate Healthcare Committee, February 14th. Happy Valentine's Day. I have a quorum now, thank goodness. I would like to, we're going to hear Senate Bill 270 first, and then go into the Senate Bill 754. And I need to know if there are people from 178. If we run out of time, I want to know if you wouldn't be able to come back on Monday if we can't get to it. It's just that I won't know that now. All right. With that, I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 270.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 270, brought to you by the Oregon Department of Justice. The measure would prohibit providers in outpatient settings from issuing adults more than a 7-day supply of opioid medications unless a greater quantity is determined medically necessary by the provider. The measure would also prohibit providers that write initial and refill opioid prescriptions of minors to a 7-day supply, again, unless a greater quantity is determined medically necessary. The provider that issues an opioid prescription that's more than a 7-day supply would need to document the patient's medical issues and indicate whether the provider considered a non-opioid alternative. The measure may have a fiscal and revenue impacts, but there are no statements issued yet. There are no amendments and testimonies available on OLIS.
Great. Ellen Rosenblum, our Attorney General.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Chair Montes Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, distinguished members of the committee. My name is Ellen Rosenblum. I'm the Oregon Attorney General, and I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 270. As Oregon's Attorney General, I am a member of the National Association of Attorneys General, also called NAG. Don't laugh too loud. As a member of this association, I attend briefings on the issues we attorneys general view as a common problem across all states, regardless of political affiliation, urban-rural divide, or physical location. Opiate addiction is in the very highest category of areas of shared concern among all attorneys general. As recently as this morning, there was a phone call discussion of the various states that are involved in this sort of proposed legislation and a number who are ahead of us. Abuse of both pharmaceutical and illegally derived opiates is spreading like wildfire across our country, and Oregon is one of the states hardest hit by this epidemic. Opiates have been a recognized and medically sanctioned method of pain management for hundreds of years. The medical use of the opium poppy predates industrialized society, and the World Health Organization recognizes the innumerable benefits of controlled opiate ingestion for many patients with pain-related conditions. Unfortunately, we have learned that even when used as directed, the risk of overdose and addiction has reached unacceptable levels. Nationally, from 2000 to 2014, nearly 500,000 people died from drug overdose. The rate of prescription opioid overdoses has quadrupled since 1999, and the numbers continue to climb. The CDC reports that 91 people die every day in the United States from opioid overdose. In 2015, opioids killed more than 33,000 people in the United States, the highest number in history. We have every reason to believe that this dark number, which has been elevated repeatedly across recent years, will only grow higher without a targeted intervention effort designed to reduce the ready supply of this useful but also potentially lethal substance. In fact, today's New York Times covered a heartbreaking story about a recent spike in Louisville, Kentucky, where in a span of 32 hours, emergency workers responded to nearly 2 calls per hour for overdoses of drugs, particularly opiates. Here in Oregon, prescription drug overdoses resulting in death more than doubled between 2000 and 2011. Besides the tragedy of the lives lost, we also pay the innumerable health care costs associated with opioid abuse and addiction, including the inevitable use of emergency medical services. According to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, emergency room visits for opioids increased 114% between 2004 and 2011, with 24 to 27% of those visits resulting in subsequent hospitalization. And in Oregon, the frequency of emergency room visits and reliance on these very expensive medical services is even higher. While this problem is certainly complicated, encompassing our medical systems, our criminal justice systems, and other important links in the broader chain of social service delivery, solutions do exist. One component of the solution is to reduce and control the prescription of pain medication. This will in turn work to control opportunities for the accidental creation of new addicts. The Center for Disease Control has issued guidance to prescribing physicians, making clear that except in unusual cases, the prescription of opiates for the purpose of managing acute pain should be limited to less than a week of supply. However, and despite these clear guidelines, we are still seeing the routine prescription of substantially larger supplies of opiates for the management of pain in very conventional cases, root canals, small surgeries, pulled muscles, etc. In 2014, enough opiates were prescribed in Oregon for nearly every person in the state to have their own bottle. Because of the profound feeling of relaxation and wellness that can accompany the consumption of an opiate, an oversupply will often be consumed by the patient until the supply is exhausted and the risk of addiction vastly elevated. Even a patient who voluntarily ceases her consumption of opiates prior to exhausting her prescription may simply leave the unused pills in her bathroom closet, where they will sit, often unattended, presenting an easy opportunity for diversion into the lucrative underground street market, where these pills are sold for 5 to 10 times their retail price. This helps to explain why some experts estimate that the illegal trafficking in prescription drugs may now be a $1 billion industry. Senate Bill 270 will reduce the risk of abuse, diversion, and addiction by reducing the number of opioids in circulation. Senate Bill 270 requires any prescribing physician to limit an initial prescription for an opiate used for pain management to 7 days, consistent with the outer limits already designated as appropriate by the CDC. If a prescriber believes it is medically necessary to prescribe an amount in excess of 7 days, they can find that one of four conditions exist, as outlined in Section 2, Subsection 2 of the bill. A, an acute medical condition. B, chronic pain. C, pain associated with a cancer diagnosis. Or D, pain experienced while the patient is in palliative care. They are required only to document this decision in the medical record. In 2013, an Oregon task force convened as part of the National Governors Association Task Force on Prescription Drug Abuse issued a number of recommendations, including that we need fewer pills in circulation, noting that, and I quote, the focus of Oregon's approach should be on changing prescriber and patient behaviors so there are fewer prescriptions for fewer pills, end quote. I agree. Senate Bill 270 will reduce the number of pills in circulation subject to abuse or diversion. This means there will be fewer pills left over after a surgery or medical treatment that can end up in the wrong hands. Senate Bill 270 also reduces the risk of accidental addiction. Accidental addiction ruins the lives that it touches, and the tragedy is the ease with which a person can become an addict simply by taking one pill a day, just like the doctor tells you, until the supply runs out. Importantly, Senate Bill 270 still leaves the judgment call to the doctor in her or his professional medical judgment and does not force a particular result. They just have to note in the patient's chart the specific reason for a longer dose. This fairly balances the need to respect the sanctity of the relationship between doctor and patient with the larger social interest in curbing the oversupply of opiates, not just on our streets, but in our bathroom cabinets. Finally, Senate Bill 270 will protect our children from opioid addiction by requiring prescribers to have a conversation with parents or guardians about the risk of opioid use while adhering to the same 7-day limit applicable to adults. Ending Oregon's opiate addiction is about the curtailment of both supply and demand, preventing pills from diversion to the illegal street markets, and working to prevent the creation of new addicts. This bill does both. So thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm available for questions.
Questions? Yes. Three things. First of all, thank you for bringing this bill. Couldn't agree with you more. Second of all, I'm not totally convinced it doesn't go far enough, that we might even need to think a little further. I've actually spoke at an opioid pain-wise conference on Saturday about public policy options to decrease our opioid crisis. This was one of the bills I discussed. And I said, you know, it's all very well and good to have this, but the current dental association guidelines in Oregon say that dentists shouldn't prescribe more than 3 days of narcotics for acute dental pain. And yet both of my girls got a week's worth after they got their wisdom teeth out. not super happy about that. And then I have to figure out what to do with them. But the other piece is this. You know, we've had a lot of conversation in the legislature about appropriate and inappropriate uses of e-clauses. This bill doesn't have an e-clause. How come? Because if there was ever an emergency, this is one of them. You know, we've got people dying every day. Not quite. I'm exaggerating. Every other day in Oregon from overdose and certainly being hospitalized every day. So why no e-clause?
Chair Manas Anderson, Senator Steiner Hayward, first of all, thank you. I am well aware that you are a physician, and I am very happy to hear of both of your concerns. I actually share your concern about the former, and truthfully, I will have to ask my staff why there's no e-clause, because it seems to me that it is certainly something that is a very current emergency, as we can see from the New York Times today and from your own personal and professional experience. So happy to look into both of those.
Thank you.
And Ms. Rosenblum, or do you have a question?
Yeah, a couple, if I could. Thank you, Madam Chair. Who has access to this information? Who, you know, how do we get jurisdiction without violating HIPAA?
Right. Chair Manas Anderson, Senator Cruz, Vice Chair Senator Cruz. I think there's nothing in the bill that gives any particular access that isn't otherwise readily available. And when I say readily, obviously there are all sorts of privacy concerns, but I believe that the board, the medical boards, the dentistry boards, have their own mechanisms for obtaining the information were they to need it. And certainly there is a provision in this bill for it being a potentially having a criminal sanction. And so if that's the case, then of course there are also mechanisms within the criminal justice system to obtain the information.
Okay. I'm always concerned about medical information which is protected, how
right.
where it potentially can go. And
right.
We certainly, well, sometimes we intend to violate federal law, but in this case I would suggest that we probably shouldn't. So.
Yes, thank you. Absolutely.
There will be testimony in opposition to the bill. I don't know what their concerns are, but if we have an impasse, I'm hoping that your staff will work with those that are in opposition to see if we can come to some agreement so that we can get 16 on the votes on the floor and 31 in the House.
Madam Chair, absolutely. I have already had the pleasure of testifying before the House committee, where I did have the opportunity to hear some of the concerns. I actually am happy to say that it didn't sound, for the most part, like an outright opposition to the bill, but definitely some concerns about sanctions, similar concerns about HIPAA and privacy issues. And we are anxious to sit down and work through those kinds of issues. We are very open to that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I would agree. We got a pretty free-flowing world. When I had my hip replacement, they gave me a bottle of Oxy when I left. And I can't remember where I put the damn thing, but I never used any of them, okay?
Right.
And, you know, it's just standard practice. I mean, these were the low-dosage ones, and I don't think the street value was very much, so I probably didn't lose much money there.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, there is a problem, I understand that, but by the same token, there are people who have long-term needs, and we need to make sure those are absolutely protected at the same time.
Right. Madam Chair, Vice Chair Cruz, I urge you tonight to go check your bathroom cabinet.
I've moved since then, so.
Oh, dear.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. Aaron Sean, Dr. Andy Antoniscus, Dr. Mark Bonaro. And if you could limit, we have we need almost an hour for the next bill and about 10 minutes for the following. So I would appreciate if you keep your comments to about 3 minutes or so.
Mm-hmm. Chair Monis Anderson and Vice Chair Cruz and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Andy Antoniscus. I'm an internist addiction medicine specialist, past president of the Oregon Society of Addiction Medicine, co-chair of the Oregon Medical Association Opioid Task Force, and was the medical director of the Providence Portland Chemical Dependency Program for about 33 years before I recently retired. So I'm certainly well aware of the consequences of substance abuse, including opioids, on the individual patient and families and the community in general. And I think that, you know, the intent of the bill with limiting the number of opioids in circulation is a good one, but I think there are certainly unintended consequences of codifying this, particularly in legislation. And you already mentioned some of the other concerns about the HIPAA and monitoring and who would be responsible about determining, particularly like with the pharmacist or whatever, with the number of medications that are prescribed. And so there are some unintended consequences that go along with this. And I also wanted to make you aware that the Oregon Health Authority has had a recent opioid prescribing task force that's met. You know, the CDC issued guidelines around chronic opioid prescribing early last year, and shortly after that, the Oregon Health Authority had this Oregon group meet that included a huge spectrum of providers in the community, including dentists, naturopaths, Oregon Pain Commission, addiction medicine providers, pharmacists, Oregon Medical Board. You know, the list goes on and on. And we met for many months, and you know, we quickly adopted the CDC guidelines for Oregon, but we realized there were some shortcomings and some Oregon-specific things that needed to be addressed, and included in that was the treatment of acute pain and the limiting of prescription medications for acute pain. And our guidelines actually had 3 days with a maximum of 7, and again documenting that this is all documented in the record. And so the Oregon Health and the CDC provided a grant for the Oregon Health Authority about disseminating this information and having it become more of a standard of care in the community, and this is well underway. And Senator Hayward, you know, this dental guidelines, those were adopted just recently, I think within the last month or so, by the Dental Association. So it's the implementation and education of providers that should become the standard of care about providing, and that's what the Oregon Health Authority is well in the way of undertaking of doing that. So I would really recommend that this committee endorse the Oregon Health Authority's move and the implementation of these guidelines in the general community as a whole. And I'm just concerned about the unintended consequences with the way the bill is currently structured. And I'll turn it over to Mr. Bonanno.
Please proceed.
Sure. Thank you. Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, my name is Mark Bonanno. I need to correct the record. I am not a doctor. I'm a juris doctor, but I don't want to pretend to be a physician. So I am general counsel for the Oregon Medical Association. Again, we support the good intent of Senate Bill 270, and you have our written testimony, and so I just want to highlight 3 points for you that are in that. The first thing is it's really important that we keep our frontline providers engaged in this issue versus making them targets for investigation. They're the folks out there on the front line. They're the folks that are treating the patients, and we really need to have them as partners in what we're doing here on the public health aspect of what we're calling an opioid crisis, particularly here in the state of Oregon as well as nationwide. The second point that we'd like to make is that we do have guidelines. The Oregon Medical Association has endorsed these guidelines. The Oregon Medical Board, our licensing board for physicians, recently in their January meeting also endorsed the guidelines. And what we would prefer to see is that we don't lock us into one form of treatment within a statute, because guidelines are going to evolve as evidence changes the way we practice medicine. So we prefer to see the use of guidelines remain guidelines rather than codify them into a statute. The final thing is, as we all know, we are not like other states like Massachusetts. We are Oregon. We have a rural area. And the way this bill is currently structured, it goes beyond just opioids. It includes both opioids and opiates. They're two different things. and it includes all schedules of drugs, not just Schedule 2. So in rural Oregon, we know a trip to the pharmacy can be an hour. And if something is a Schedule 5 drug, like a cough syrup with codeine, making multiple trips to the pharmacy in rural Oregon just doesn't seem to better patient care. So I'll stop there if there are any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Please proceed.
Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, my name is Hans Notenboom. I am the president of the Oregon chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians. I'm an emergency physician out of Eugene, Oregon for the past 17 years now. I would echo some of the comments today to say that we do appreciate the intent of this bill, but are not sure that the actual execution will get us to the place that we need to be. I would offer an alternative and maybe a couple of concerns. And I'll start with the concerns in that I would echo that access issues could be unintended consequence of this bill. For example, multiple copays for patients, multiple visits to their physician, multiple copays to the pharmacy, in addition to the fact that it would potentially require multiple visits. And we already have an access issue in the state for patients already. In addition to that, I would say that one of the comments that was made in the initial testimony was related to a criminal code with medical care. And that is something that we would also be against, because that is something that we think criminalizing medical care or perception can be a dangerous thing. As an alternative, I would point out that one thing that we also heard is it's commonly thought, hey, emergency medicine, we're the front line, we're the common people that deal with this. But in fact, the FDA has noted that we're about 4.7% of the prescriptions written for these acute opioid pain medications. And despite that, we've developed guidelines through the Oregon College of Emergency or American Chapter of Emergency Physicians, that are in line with the American College or the national chapter, and we've shown the largest decrease in the use of opioid prescriptions in the country of about 9%. That's with guidelines, not with specific numbers, not with any criminal punishment, but guidelines that include education. We use things in this state such as the Emergency Department Information Exchange Program. We also employ the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, and we have other tools that we use. This is on our front burner. We discussed this at our conferences. We just had a specific talk for this at our Oregon winter conference for emergency physicians. So there are methods out there that we think could move the needle on this, because we also would agree it's very important. But we're just not sure that this bill is the thing that will move the needle as much as possible. And we think that there are other people that could learn from the guidelines that we've adopted and some others to help improve this situation. Open for any questions. Thank you.
Questions? Thanks so very much for taking the time to bring your testimony to us. Jessica Adams, and then ending up with Aaron Sean.
Thank you, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. For the record, Jessica Adamson representing Providence Health and Services. While we absolutely agree with the goals of Senate Bill 270, and as an organization have spent a lot of time making sure that our physicians and specialists prescribe the right amount of opioids and opiates and not any more than are necessary, and continue that work in coordination with the guidelines that have just come out and continue to be evolved through the state's work group. We are, unfortunately, today opposed to this bill, certainly as written. Would echo the comments of the OMA and the emergency physicians, and in the interest of time, I will not repeat any of them, but would like to identify another very specific issue. Again, we don't believe that this was intended as part of the legislation and are happy to work to fix it. As Section 3 on the back is written, the criminal penalties apply not only to the prescribers, but to the pharmacists who dispense. And so what we are concerned about is whether, as written, the language would require the pharmacist to confirm that a prescription beyond 7 days was correctly documented in the medical record. And if failure to do so would result in criminal penalties for that pharmacist. We have a variety of pharmacies within Providence. Some of those are external facing retail clinics that serve more than Providence patients. Pharmacists, as a general rule, do not have access necessarily to the electronic health record. Certainly to folks that are outside of our system, they would not have access to that. So there would be no easy way for the pharmacist to know whether that was properly done, but yet could be exposed to a criminal penalty for an action over which they would have no control. So again, I think there are some underlying concerns about this bill, but that's one specific issue that had not yet been mentioned today that we wanted to highlight as something, if this bill is to move forward, needs to be addressed in order to enable pharmacists to rely on the piece of paper that's in front of them and that the prescriber had done the appropriate work to make sure that they were in compliance with the law. Happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you very much. And evidently, Erin Sean was not here. She's from the Oregon Nurses Association, Nurse Practitioner Organization. And they did testify. They would have given us testimony in favor of the bill.
Yes. Madam Chair, if I could, just one more comment. I think it was 16 years ago, I was the chief sponsor of a piece of legislation that created the Oregon Pain Commission. And one of the issues we were dealing with there was reluctance back then of physicians to prescribe opioids, specifically for fear of BME coming down hard on them. And I think it was appropriate at that point in time. And while the intent here is good, I just want to make sure that the pendulum doesn't swing too far back the other way. That's
it. Madam Chair, thank you. Senator Cruz, thank you so much for those comments. As I mentioned, I gave a talk on this very issue on Saturday morning, and I said to the other healthcare providers in the room, I don't know about you, but I felt a little whipsawed. As a physician, I felt a little whipsawed about the too much, too little, too much, too little, too much, too little on the opiate side and pain management side. But, Madam Chair, if I might, I would suggest to Madam Attorney General and her colleagues that one of the ways to address some of the concerns that have been raised is to bring together folks from the Oregon Medical Board and the Board of Pharmacy and of obviously any of the concerned parties, but having a plan in place that could be publicly stated were this bill to proceed about how the Medical Board might work with this or the Board of Pharmacy might work with this might obviate some of the concerns that have been raised in ways that are constructive and supportive of both sides of the issue. So if I could make that suggestion.
Thank you very much, everyone, and we'll see where the votes are, and you let us know how to proceed. All right, with that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 270 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 754, and would like to invite Mason Thurman, Shauna Jepson, and Dave Stuckey. And again, if we can keep it to 2 minutes because we have 20 people signed up and 20 minutes times two is 40 minutes.
Absolutely. Actually, I'd like to go first if that's okay with you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dave Stuckey. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. I'm also a retired Army. Joining me today is Shauna Jepson, who is our Health Promotion Officer within the Oregon Medical Command. And she's going to, in a moment, I'll turn it over to her and she can highlight a couple of the medical components to tobacco use. The Oregon Military Department is in support of Senate Bill 754. The Adjutant General, Major General Stencil, has provided written acknowledgement of this support. His letter has been provided to the committee, Madam Chair, and is on OLIS today. For us, we view this as a readiness issue. Having soldiers and airmen of the Oregon National Guard that are resilient and fit physically and mentally, as well as trained and equipped, is our top priority. Reducing tobacco use will have that positive impact. There's been a long history of pro-tobacco use within the military. As a son of an Army dad, I remember back in the 70s opening up C rations and seeing, you know, four packs of Pall Malls sitting in that compartment. As a career military person, and a user of tobacco, smokeless tobacco for 32 years, the entire time I served in the Army. I was finally able to quit in 2012, and no matter how many times I tried to quit while I was in uniform, The answer for those that would respond in uniform when I was telling them about my story was, hey, sir, no one likes a quitter. And so this is something that exists in the military. It's almost a pro-culture of tobacco use in the military, and I think it's time to end. So from our standpoint, reducing the use within the Oregon National Guard will have an immediate impact, positive impact, and on the resiliency and capabilities of our state's National Guard. And so with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions or wait till later.
Let's wait till we hear from the panel.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Mona's Anderson, members of the Senate Committee on Health Care, Senator Steiner Hayward. Sponsor of this bill, 754. I'm Shauna Jepson, Health Promotion Officer with the Oregon National Guard within the Deputy State Surgeon's Office and Medical Command. The Secretary of Defense and the Department of Defense realize the negative effects smoking has had on the individuals and our readiness as a force. Several regulations and initiatives are currently in place. For example, we have the no smoking in specific restrictions in wear and facilities, also in no vehicles. There's no smoking for instructors, no students in any training area, facility, or smoking or use of tobacco products in medical facilities. That being said, it's like the leaders lead. So no providers are not allowed to smoke in front of others going through their processes, physical health exams. The military in the state of Hawaii supports lifting the age to 21. Several branches have restricted even further use of tobacco products to include recreation areas, and has increased the cost of tobacco products to match that of civilian retailers and commissaries and exchanges. A recent study in the health of the force stated smokers make up between 30 and 42% of our military population. Oregon Military Department, in approaching the health of their members, try to approach the health of their members as holistically as possible. We know there is more to ready and resilient than just passing the mental health screenings and the physical health assessments. As smoking is the leading preventable cause in death and disease in the United States, most smokers start before the age of 21, and service members have a higher rate of smoking than civilians, our force is at a high risk for death and disease, non-combat related. Smokers have 90% higher risk of injury and disease than non-smokers, which costs the Pentagon $1.3 billion a year in medical cost and lost production. If an accident occurs while a service member is on military orders, we purchase that injury. And then when a service member separates, the Department of Veteran Affairs picks up that cost. Studies show the military and deployments are associated with smoking initiation and more strongly with smoking recidivism. So these are people that are going into the military. There's a 1.3% of them becoming smokers after they join. And then after deployment, 2.3% for those who deploy. For people who smoked previously, gave it up, and then joined the military, there's a 28.7% that they're going to start smoking again. And as they deployed, it's 39.4%. And then an increase for smokers, people who come in already smoking, that increases to 44% and then to 57% among people who deploy. On top of the expense the Pentagon sees for medical and loss production, there's also those costs that are related to attrition. 45% of our service members fight due to non-medical issues. The study compared academic levels, graduate versus non-graduate, and mental, high versus low, and then those against smokers. And in each of those categories, the smokers were more likely to attrite than those who didn't. The Department of Defense spends between, depending on what the military occupation is when they come in, $80,000 to $120,000 on a service member for their first year. Thank you for this opportunity to provide testimony today and to share the serious effects of smoking on the military. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Let's go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Miles Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee. My name is Peter Reed. I'm a pediatrician. I work and live in Portland, Oregon. I also work some in Tigard, Oregon, with Pediatric Associates of the Northwest. And I'm also a member of the Children's Health Alliance, which is a group of over 100 pediatricians representing the Portland metro area as well as the Salem metro area. And I'm here today to represent the Alliance as well as myself. So we support this bill, the Tobacco 21 Bill, 754. I'd like to share two brief stories from my practice with you. The first is from a couple of years ago while I was in training, working in the pediatric ICU. I had a patient who I'll call Angela, who was a five-year-old who was admitted to the ICU on a Monday with an asthma exacerbation. She had spent the weekend at her father's house, and her father was a smoker and smoked indoors. And this was not the first time she'd been admitted for this problem. And her, when she was first admitted, her blood oxygen level was quite low, and she'd been getting her albuterol at regular intervals, as she was supposed to be, but it just wasn't enough. And we had to put her on high-flow oxygen and continuous albuterol, which is a fairly drastic measure. And she was on continuous albuterol for 2 days and was in the ICU for 5 days before finally being discharged with a hospital bill of probably about $100,000 that was paid for by Medicaid. We counseled her father while she was there, and her father certainly loves her, but the danger that his smoking was posing to her. But unfortunately, she was readmitted just 2 months later for the same issue. And this is not an uncommon story. The second patient I'll tell you about, I'll call Michael, is a current patient of mine who's 19 and chews tobacco. And he started chewing tobacco when he was 15. And he came to me about a year ago and said he wanted to quit. And so I, a pediatrician, prescribed some nicotine patches for him and referred him to the quit line and did all the things that I could do to help him to quit his tobacco habit, which he successfully did for a few months, but he's since again started. So these stories illustrate the impacts of tobacco and the terrible addiction that is that can start at a young age. And in one case, it was the father's addiction endangering his daughter's life, and then the teenager who's having trouble breaking the cycle now. And again, these are just two stories, but everybody in the Children's Health Alliance has many patients who are affected by tobacco.
Thank you.
I think that you are aware of many of the statistics of the financial statistics of the impacts of tobacco, so I will leave that.
And have you have you submitted your testimony to the committee?
I have not, but I will follow in.
Please do that, because we do have to limit your testimony. So I'm sorry, but in order to get
Might I make one more point?
Yes,
Madam
please.
Chair? Thank you. Which is that the reason for that we support this bill raising the age from 18 to 21 is that age group is one of the key suppliers for tobacco products to teenagers, and teenagers are getting hooked because of starting at that younger age, getting tobacco from their older friends. And so raising that age will help to break that cycle. 9 out of 10 adult smokers started before they were 18. So that's the main reason that we support this bill.
Great. Questions? Thank you so much. Okay, Jason Weber, Charles Wyatt, and Atranu Gonzalez. Please proceed.
Madam Chair, Senator Monis-Anderson, Vice Chair Senator Cruz, and members of the committee. My name is Jason Weber of Roseburg, Oregon. I own a vape shop in Roseburg that employs 5 people, 2 of which are under the age of 21. I did read SB 754, and although I do consider myself an expert in the vaping industry, I am not an expert on reading bills. However, I do have a couple concerns as a business owner with this bill, Section 4, lines 19 through 23, directs me as an employer, specifically line 22, where it uses the word shall, to confiscate any tobacco or inhalant delivery system from my employees under the age of 21, should they be vaping or smoking on a break or any other time during the time that they are on the clock with me. As this reads to me, I am forced to do this. So I'm wondering, what if I don't, and what happens to me? Am I open to any violations or penalties that would affect my license should licensure for vape shops become law in the future? Also, I'm not sure by reading the bill, but maybe I could get some clarification regarding if my employees under the age of 21 would even be allowed to work in my shop. If the legal age to vape is 21 and I have 2 employees under that age that work for me, would I have to fire 2 of those employees who are dependent on their jobs to feed their families and pay their rent? The only other thing I have to add is I'm worried this will send the customers I have that are between 18 and 21 back to smoking, as it is easier to get a hold of cigarettes than it is a vaporizer. I myself started smoking cigarettes at the age of 14 because it was easier to get a hold of. You know, we can ask to bum cigarettes off friends, friends stealing from their parents. No one's willing to loan their expensive vaporizer out, and we would notice if it was missing if someone were to steal it. I can only wish that this life-saving technology was around back then. I can say that you don't want to make it harder for young adults to quit smoking with a 95% safer alternative. And may I add also that it has a proven 70% success rate compared to the 7% success rate of smoking cessation products such as nicotine gum, patches, and lozenges. I appreciate you giving me the time to say my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, Senator Mons Anderson, and Vice Chair Senator Cruz, and members of the committee. My name is Charles Wyatt, a previous 7-year smoker. I really feel that this bill is written very poorly in the fact that it's grouping our vaporizers in with big tobacco, with tobacco in all. The Institute of Medicine did not factor in the availability of vapor products in their estimates in this bill. They also did not factor in including vapor products and raising the minimum legal purchase age. For this reason, any committee hearing T21 bills should be at the very least urged to hold the bill over for further study. I wish that these products were around much earlier. Seeing as I was a smoker from the age of 15, I was able to, yes, bum cigarettes off of my friends. It was very readily available. It breaks my heart that it took me this long to actually break that habit. And now that I have broken that habit, I regain a quality of life that I never thought I would have again. My breathing, my ability to exercise, I can get up and run a mile with my dogs. I feel so much better. And, that quality of life, I feel like I have because of this product. And there are I think it's silly that, somebody can sign up at the age of 18 to go off to the military fight and potentially die for our country, but wouldn't have the availability to products to help them quit smoking cigarettes. And like Jason said, being a 95% safer alternative, I feel that that should be available to anybody over the age of 18 that has previously had exposure to tobacco cigarettes. If you have any questions, you're more than willing to ask. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming.
Madam Chair, Senator Mons Anderson, Vice Chair, Senator Cruz, and members of the committee. My name is Atreyu Gonzalez, and I began smoking at the age of 14, and I, from personal experience, me and my friends would steal from our parents who were over the age of 21, well in their 40s, and that's how many like me began smoking. I smoked for years, and then until I was about 18, I found an alternative of an electronic cigarette vaporizer, and that helped me quit, and I noticed in my health and everything. And then I recently, about 5 months ago, my great-grandmother became ill and broke her arm, and I had to go to California to look after her. I walked in to the local vape shop around there, tried to buy what I needed so I could continue to vape and not smoke, and I had to be 21. So I went to my grandmother's house on my mom's side, who had been smoking since she was young, and she loves me with all her heart, and she can't leave the house, but she has cigarettes delivered to her, so the only way that I could have my nicotine intake was I'd ask her for a pack of cigarettes, and was then back on cigarettes because of that law. Then that thank you for your time.
Thank you for coming, and thank you for sharing your stories. I appreciate it. All right, with that, I would like to call forward is it Mason Thurman, and then Sarah Harstein and Don Emmerich. I don't
I guess I will then. Thank you, Chair Anderson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mason Thurman, and I'm a senior at Valley Catholic in Beaverton. I'm here today to speak in support of SB 754 because I see the effects of tobacco on my friends and my classmates every day. According to the 2015 Oregon Health Use Survey, nearly a quarter of 11th graders in Oregon reported using tobacco or e-cigarettes in the past 30 days. But for me, teen smoking is more than just a statistic. My best friend started smoking when he was 14. He was given cigarettes by his cousin, who was 19 at the time. Over the last 2 years, I've seen his dependency on nicotine grow. Now my best friend uses tobacco every day. Being the age 18 and a few months older than many of my friends and peers, they naturally look to me to provide them with tobacco products. While I turn them down, it doesn't stop them from asking another classmate who doesn't understand the deadly impact of tobacco. SB 754 is a common sense proposal to ensure my classmates and friends cannot easily access tobacco and begin a lifelong habit. I support raising the age of sale for tobacco and e-cigarettes because it would remove access from high schools all over Oregon, ensuring young people are less likely to begin smoking tobacco or e-cigarettes in the first place. I urge you to vote yes on SB 754 to protect young people like my best friend. Thank you for the opportunity to address the committee today.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Hartstein, and I'm the Health Policy Specialist for Benton County Health Department. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Coalition of Local Health Officials to support raising the minimum age for sale of tobacco products to 21. The Benton County Board of Commissioners consider the public's health and safety to be a top priority, which is why they recently passed a resolution encouraging the Oregon legislature to increase the sale age for tobacco and other nicotine products to 21. I've submitted the resolution for the record. Increasing the sale age of tobacco and other nicotine products to 21 will have a positive impact on tobacco use prevalence, as 95% of adults who currently use tobacco started smoking before the age of 21. Postponing the age when young people first begin using nicotine products can reduce the risk that they will become addicted and prevent unnecessary deaths, disease, and healthcare costs caused by tobacco use. In addition to Benton County's Tobacco 21 resolution, the Board of Commissioners and Benton County have taken steps to protect the community's health by reducing exposure and access to tobacco and nicotine products, by strengthening our local smoke-free workplace law to prohibit smoking in vape shops, smoke shops, and hookah lounges, and expanding our local tobacco retail license requirements to include licensure of vape shops, and to prohibit issuance of a license to a tobacco retailer at a location within a distance of 1,000 feet of schools or within 1,000 feet of another tobacco retailer. On behalf of the Oregon Coalition of Local Health Officials, I urge you to support Senate Bill 754. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Good afternoon, Chair Monez Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the Senate Health Care Committee. For the record, my name is Dawn Emmerich. I'm the Director of Public Health for Clackamas County. Thank you for the opportunity for us to appear in front of you today representing Clackamas County's support for SB 754, a very significant public health legislation. Clackamas County sees raising the minimum wage of legal access to tobacco and nicotine products to the age of 21 as a complementary to the other youth tobacco use prevention strategies, including the tobacco retail licensing, in which I was here last earlier in the week. Strong indoor smoke-free laws and evidence-based tobacco use prevention and cessation programs. The primary purpose of raising the minimum legal age to purchase and the use of tobacco and nicotine products is to prevent or delay the initiation of adolescence and young adults. In the United States, 95% of smokers began using tobacco before 21, as we've heard earlier today, and 90% first try smoking before the age of 18, also confirmed today. Data from the 2015 Oregon Healthy Teen Survey indicates that over a quarter of 11th graders, 28% in Clackamas County, use some form of tobacco product within the last 30 days. Delaying the age when young people first experiment or begin using tobacco or other nicotine products can reduce the risk that they transition to regular or daily use of tobacco and increase their chances of successfully quitting if they do become regular users. Data from the 2015 Institute of Medicine report also predicts that raising the minimum age for the sale of tobacco products to 21 will reduce the smoking prevalence rate by 12% and smoking-related deaths by 10%, which translates to 223,000 fewer premature deaths and will save millions of dollars in health care costs. Clackamas County supports two principles currently within this bill. One, raise the minimum age of legal access to tobacco and nicotine products to the age of 21. This will align with how alcohol and marijuana sales are regulated and can reduce the burden on sales to the clerks, determining each customer's lawful age of the purchase. Number two, continue to penalize the illegal sale of tobacco and nicotine products where the majority of the responsibility of the sale remains on the retailer. Finally, the Clackamas County Commissioners strongly support raising the legal age of tobacco and nicotine products to 21 and see Senate Bill 754 will help reduce youth tobacco use and increase the likelihood that youth will grow up to be tobacco free. We urge you to support Senate Bill 754. Thank you so much for the opportunity to really do what's right on behalf of public health and the citizens of Clackamas County.
Questions? Thank you so much.
So just if I could, ma'am, I want to thank my constituent, Mason Thurman, who volunteered to come when he heard I was doing this bill because of the reasons he stated here today.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Melinda Madden and then Dr. Minot Cleveland and Ryan Day. Melinda, you go first.
Madam Chair, Senator Moniz Anderson, Vice Chair Senator Cruz, and members of the committee, my name is Melinda, and I just wanted to share with you my story. When I was 13 years old, I first picked up cigarettes, and I started smoking. I had them readily available to me because of my grandmother, who got them delivered to her house in large quantities, and I did not have any friends that would be of age to be able to supply them for me. When I was 18, after many years of being on and off cigarettes, I found a local vape shop, and I stopped smoking from using vaporizer products, and from there I got incredibly passionate about helping others quit smoking. Every time that I would upgrade to a new device, I would be finding my friends that still had smoking as a habit, and I would be getting them started on vaping instead of smoking as well. And then that's when I got hired on at a vape shop too in Linn County. And now I can live my passion every single day helping people quit smoking. And I see more people that come in that are younger than 21, 18 or above, that are able to come in and quit smoking from when they were able to get cigarettes from their parents or their friends at a young age. And it's helping me when it comes to developing myself as a person to help people quit smoking and be able to further themselves in their health. And I know that if this bill passes, I am not only going to lose that because I will lose my job as well since I am not 21, but it would also be heartbreaking for me to not be able to help people that are 18 or above quit smoking, as I see more people that are of the young age rather than people who are older that come in and quit smoking that way. I feel like if we help people quit smoking using vaporizer products at a younger age, then we will be able to highly impact the amount of young smokers that are here. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Chair Moniz Anderson, Chair Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Minot Cleveland. I'm an internal medicine specialist at Legacy Health, and I'm here today as the chair of the American Heart Association's Advocacy Committee. I want to thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 754, Tobacco 21. Tobacco kills. Smoking is a major risk factor for the number one killer in America, cardiovascular disease. It's the number one killer of American men and women. Go red for women, prevent heart disease in women. Smoking is also a major risk factor for the number five killer in America, stroke. Cardiovascular disease accounts for one of every three deaths in the U.S. Heart disease claims a life every 40 seconds, a metronome of death. So in a one-hour committee hearing, that's 90 lives lost. Of course, the health consequences of tobacco extend far beyond heart disease. Lung cancer is the leading cause of cancer deaths among men, and since 1985, the number one cancer killer of women. 90% of all lung cancers are caused by tobacco, and therefore, nearly all lung cancer deaths are preventable. Tobacco also causes emphysema and chronic bronchitis, other cancers, and dramatically worsens diabetes. Children exposed to secondhand smoke are at increased risk for sudden infant death syndrome, acute respiratory infections, more middle ear infections, more severe asthma, and slowed lung growth. One in three young smokers will die from a smoking-related disease unless they quit. But these disturbing statistics do not capture the personal impact of these smoking-related diseases. Earlier in my career, I was a member of the general medicine faculty at the Portland VA Medical Center. I had the chance to work with former prisoners of war from World War II. These were the toughest, most resilient people I have ever known, and yet some of them were not able to quit smoking. Since quitting smoking is challenging, never starting to smoke is the key. At the American Heart Association, we say, life is why. I have volunteered for the Heart Association for over 30 years. What is my why? Minot Cleveland, my namesake, the grandfather I never saw, died at 66 from a stroke. My father died at 66 from a heart attack. Both my mother and my sister died from heart attacks and congestive heart failure. Help prevent heart disease and other tobacco-related diseases, and please help young people live long lives tobacco-free. I urge you to support Senate Bill 754. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Moniz Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, my name is Ryan Day, and I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the March of Dimes. As many of you might know, the March of Dimes is one of the leading organizations that fights for women and babies in this country. I think that no one can doubt that the love of a mother for their child is one of the strongest forces that we've ever seen. But I think many of you would be surprised to see that tobacco can overwhelm that love that a mother feels for their child. In the state of Oregon, 10.6% of women who admit to smoking during their third trimester of pregnancy. You'll find that among 18 to 24-year-olds, those women who smoke during pregnancy are at the rate above 18%. We're talking about almost one in five women who smoke during pregnancy are in the target demographic that is going to be most impacted by this bill. These are the women that we want to make sure never start smoking, and the consequences of smoking are quite dramatic. Smoking while pregnant can increase prematurity by 50% and increase low birth weight by 90%. In a state like Oregon, where 50% of Medicaid births are 50% of births are paid by the state's Medicaid program, you would also be shocked to find that almost one in five women in the state's Medicaid program smoke while pregnant as well. This has dramatic effects both on the children and the mothers that have to experience this, but also on the state's budget. The average premature or low birth weight baby born in the state costs an average of $49,000 in the first year of life, as compared to $4,500 for a normal no complications birth. Smoking is a scourge on our society, I think most would believe, but I think it's especially heartbreaking that we allow this to impact our most vulnerable. Thank you very much, and if you have any questions, we're happy to answer.
Thank you. Questions? All right. Kay and Eric Brodell and Stacy Michelson.
Thank you.
Chair Monis Anderson and Vice Chair Cruz, I am, and the rest of the committee, I'm here today as myself, Kay Graven, and I'm here to tell my story and to ask you to raise the selling age of tobacco to 21 to protect our kids. I smoked my first cigarette when I was 16 years old. I bought it in a vending machine in a hotel lobby. That ages me pretty badly there. But I was excited about it. It was fun. It was exciting. It was. I was away from home, and I did something a little naughty. Well, the backfire of that is that I also went ahead and smoked as often as I could for the next couple of years. And I depended on older friends and sales clerks who weren't checking my identification to get cigarettes. At 18, I went off to college on my own, happy to be legally smoking and quickly addicted to cigarettes. I smoked for another 18 years, not something I'm very proud of, but my friend smoked and my dad smoked, and it seemed like the thing to do. Most of us here understand that the underage tobacco use can lead to a lifetime of addiction. We have statistics to prove it, and we have people like me to tell their story and prove it. What most of us do not know is how tobacco inhalant systems, like e-cigarettes, are expanding the problem of underage tobacco use. A study published last month by the University of California, San Francisco, found that combined e-cigarette and cigarette use among adolescents in 2014 was higher than total cigarette use in 2009. The study also concluded that low-risk youth, who may not have used nicotine at all if e-cigarettes were not available, used e-cigarettes and went on to smoke cigarettes. I personally think that would have been a great option for me because I could have maybe hidden my problem a little bit longer. This builds to the point that adolescents who start with e-cigarettes are more likely to subsequently smoke traditional cigarettes. This is why I'm here today, to ask you to raise the age of the sale of all tobacco products to 21. We need to protect our kids from a lifetime of addiction. I can say from experience that kicking this addiction was one of the hardest things that I ever did in my lifetime, and I do not want to see other children get exposed to the opportunity to smoke and have to fight with that addiction the rest of their lives. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Eric Brodell, and I am the Western Region Director for the Preventing Tobacco Addiction Foundation. Thank you for allowing me to submit testimony today in strong support of SB 754, which would limit the sales and purchase of all nicotine and tobacco products, including inhalants such as electronic cigarettes, to those over 21. According to the U.S. Surgeon General, 5.6 million American children alive today will die prematurely from smoking unless our trajectory changes. For those who die, 68,000 will be children in Oregon. In 2015, a congressionally mandated 347-page report compiled by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration and the Institute of Medicine focused on a way to reduce this toll, raise the minimum legal sales age of all tobacco products to 21. The report titled Public Health Implications of Raising the Minimum Age of Legal Access to Tobacco details the overwhelming evidence of this policy. Using very conservative assumptions, the report indicates that this policy alone would result in a 12% decrease in tobacco use. Already legal access to handguns, alcohol, casino gambling, and marijuana is limited to those over 21. Nicotine and tobacco kill five times as many people as these other high-risk activities. Nicotine addiction is also a pediatric disease. 95% of smokers started before the age of 21. Neurobiological evidence also underscores what parents and teachers and adolescents already know. Kids' developmental urge for exploration, independence, adulthood, peer acceptance encourages them to take risks that most rational adults would not. This drive also puts them squarely in the crosshairs of predatory marketing by tobacco and nicotine purveyors. An argument by retailers is one of lost revenue. However, the facts suggest otherwise. Individuals aged 18 to 20 comprise only 2.1% of all tobacco sales nationally, and in the two states and 224 cities covering almost 63 million people in our country that have already adopted age 21, there has been no evidence of significant retailer injury. It's worth noting that 2.1% of sales to 18 to 20-year-olds make up 85% of underage consumption of tobacco products. Tobacco 21 is also a revenue-boosting policy. A drop in Medicaid expenditures will be most representative in the area of smoking during pregnancy. Like my colleague from the March of Dimes noted, young women ages 18 to 21 have the highest rate of pregnancy smoking. That rate's often 50% higher than older women. Mothers who smoke have twice the rate of infant mortality, suffer much higher rates of miscarriage, stillbirth, premature death, birth defects, and sudden infant death syndrome. Long hospital stays and possible lifelong infant disabilities are costly to Medicaid and devastating to the families involved. Addiction prevention is the real key to this policy. One final word about inhalant delivery systems. E-cigarettes and vapor devices are sweeping the adolescent market. Some claim that these devices reduce dangerous traditional cigarette use, but what we do know is they cause nicotine addiction and long-lasting changes to sensitive neuroreceptors in the adolescent brain. For adolescents and pregnant women, it is the nicotine that causes the damage, not the tars. These products should also move to age 21, and we fully support their more explicit and expanded definition. In summary, the scientific and social evidence that age 21 works to prevent death, save babies, and reduce costs is overwhelming. Thank you for your dedication to health and preserving a healthy future for Oregon's youth. I'm available for any questions that you may have.
Thanks. Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Stacey Michelson. I'm here on behalf of the Association of Oregon Counties and here today to speak in favor of SB 754. For those of you who are familiar with AOC, you know that our mantra in this building is generally local control. We often would prefer that the state not pass statewide policy and give our commissioners the ability to make decisions at the local level that are best suited to their communities. But this is an issue where many of our members, in fact, have actually preferred a statewide platform. It makes things a little easier on them to not have a patchwork of policies across the state, and it was actually part of our discussion on Monday where we had very robust dialogue around this issue, and some of our folks said explicitly that they were waiting in their county to see if there was statewide action on this issue before they took it up at the local level. So our folks are really looking for you all to take the lead on this particular issue. As the local public health authority, our folks are very vested in conversations about tobacco and tobacco usage. Our members are very much aligned with their local public health officials around this issue from the public health standpoint. But I will tell you that much of the discussion in our legislative committee yesterday afternoon mirrored much of the conversation that we've heard today. It was very personal stories, members talking about their own beginning smoking at a young age, struggling with addiction, concerns over their own teenage children who are in high school, potentially having access to cigarettes or being asked to purchase for other students. And it was a very passionate discussion, and our folks voted pretty overwhelmingly on this issue to support SB 754. So I urge you to take that into consideration. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions now.
Thank you. One question for Ms. Michelson and one question for the other two panelists. Ms. Michelson, we had county commissioners from Klamath and Blaine County here. The Commissioner DeGroote from Klamath County pointed out that in a fairly conservative part of the state, they were supporting this. Is there an urban-rural divide at all among AOC, or is the support for this pretty broad?
There really isn't an urban-rural divide on this issue. In fact, I think perhaps even more rural than Klamath County. I had a conversation with one of our commissioners from Morrow County yesterday who spoke up on this issue, even in our Health and Human Services Steering Committee, and made the point that he is generally a libertarian and often, you know, prefers to not have additional regulation. But from the perspective of children's health, this was one issue where he would take a strong stance in favor of more regulation.
Thank you. And if I may, Madam Chair, I want to clarify something that you said, Karen, or maybe Eric, you can help us out here. Did you say that while for adults it helps to get off of tobacco, that vapes help them get off of tobacco, as several witnesses have testified, but for children, younger people who start with vaping, the data suggests that that actually leads them into using tobacco later? Is that, did I hear you correctly?
The study from California says yes. That their data shows them that low risk to smoke at all kids might try vaping or e-cigarettes that could lead later to an actual addiction to cigarettes. So that's the data that they produced in that study.
So it's reversed from what we see with adults, where vaping has been shown to be effective in some populations to
according
help them
to
stop using tobacco products.
It's also worth noting that some studies are suggesting that while e-cigarettes are harm reduction techniques and that some smokers use them to quit, they end up using both. It ranges from anywhere from 80 to 85% of users who end up circling back and using cigarettes and e-cigarettes at the same time.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming. Karen Gerard and Adams and Emson, and those are the final two. I have a number of people that crossed their names off for testifying. So Rosa Klein, Multnomah County, wants to come up. Can they come up now, too? Yeah.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson here with Providence Health and Services. You've heard lengthy testimony in favor of this bill, and we would just simply add our names to that and add one perspective that we have as a entity that cares for a lot of the Medicaid population, both as a payer and a provider. Use in the OHP population of tobacco is about twice of that of the general population, and about 10% of the costs in the OHP budget are related to tobacco use. What we know is a lot of tobacco use starts between the ages of 18 and 21. And if we can prevent folks from struggling with lifelong addiction related to tobacco use by delaying allowance of purchasing of tobacco till 21, that will have long-term benefits to the health of Oregonians and cost to the Medicaid budget. So we would encourage swift consideration and support for this bill.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. It's good to be with you again. I'm Dr. Jennifer Vines. I'm the Deputy Health Officer for Multnomah County Health Department. I've worked in primary care and public health for the last decade in the Portland metro area. You've heard from a lot of physicians both last week and this week. I want to add my voice to that drumbeat. Again, there's a lot of energy around this for us, for those of us who work in healthcare, because of the disabling and disfiguring painful conditions that smoking leads to, and the fact that we all know, and you've heard time and time again, that people start in large part before they're even 19 years old. The Institute of Medicine in their 2015 report cited up to close to a quarter million fewer premature deaths across the country, and I would love to see Oregon have our share in that. So again, a lot of energy around this in the medical and public health community because it's really the right thing to do. I want to just also sort of address this notion that we're somehow depriving teen smokers from nicotine replacement. I will point out that there are FDA-approved nicotine replacement patches, inhalers, gum that are available to people who have health insurance, and most people do have health insurance. So again, the idea that you can separate nicotine from all the harmful things in tobacco is not new. That's available. And I also think in general, on the whole, we lose if we are recruiting a new generation of kids using nicotine, which has its own health effects. And we know that the young brain is uniquely sensitive to the addictive effects of nicotine. So again, I think this is the right thing to do, to include both tobacco and other forms of nicotine, including inhalant devices, and fully support Senate Bill 754. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Sanderson, members of the committee. I'm Karen Gerard with the Health Promotion and Chronic Disease Prevention section of the Oregon Health Authority. Oregon's Tobacco Prevention and Education Program is an evidence-based program that is highly effective. Since TPEP started in 1997, cigarette consumption in Oregon has reduced by 50%. TPEP works in partnership with local public health authorities and tribes to prevent and reduce tobacco-related deaths in every Oregon community. And as you've heard today, despite these declines in tobacco use, it remains the number one preventable cause of death and disease in Oregon, and tobacco is responsible for over 7,000 deaths a year in our state. As you've heard, most addiction to tobacco starts in adolescence. 9 out of 10 adults who smoke report they started before turning 18, and almost 100% started before age 26. Research shows that kids often turn to older friends and classmates as sources of tobacco, as younger kids have regular contact with older friends who can legally purchase tobacco. Among Oregon 8th grade students who smoke cigarettes, 1 in 4 report obtaining tobacco from friends who are 18 or older. Raising the tobacco sale age to 21 would reduce the likelihood that young adults would be able to legally purchase tobacco products for other students and underage friends. Raising the minimum legal sale age for tobacco products to 21 is a promising strategy to reduce smoking and other tobacco use among Oregon youth. As you've heard, over 200 jurisdictions in two states have passed a policy raising the minimum age to 21. And in addition, a recent survey of Oregon adults showed that two-thirds of Oregonians support raising the minimum legal sale age to 21. Laws that raise the minimum legal sale age are important, but without adequate enforcement and other tobacco control efforts, raising the age alone will not keep kids from using tobacco and nicotine products. We know that to prevent youth initiation of tobacco products, we must take a comprehensive approach that includes reducing youth exposure to products that are cheap, readily available, and easy to find. The Oregon Health Authority appreciates the committee addressing this very important issue. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, that's our final panel. Any questions?
If I may take a small point of personal privilege. Dr. Cleveland was one of my faculty when I was a resident. I was one of Dr. Vine's faculty when she was a resident. So we're seeing the benefits of the level of medical training that we do in this state about keeping Oregonians healthy. So it's nice to be in the room with both of you. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you. One last call for anyone else who would like to testify. All right. We will be probably having a possible work session on Thursday. Staff has listed that on the agenda for Thursday. Okay. No further comments. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 754 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 178. Mr. Dockers.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 178, the measure extends the Oregon Rural Practitioner Tax Credit Program for 6 years through January 1st, 2024. Oregon's Rural Provider Tax Credit Program provides health care providers a non-refundable tax credit of up to $5,000 against their personal income taxes. And the program is scheduled currently to sunset on January 1st, 2018. There is no fiscal impact. There is a revenue impact. However, as the measure extends the number of tax credits, you have both of the fiscal and revenue impact statements with you. They're available on OLIS. There are no amendments, and testimony is also available on OLIS.
Great. All right. Robert Fumig and, I guess, Doug Barber. Let's have you two. Or do you want to? Who wants to go next? I don't care. Katie Harris, there's Robert Dumick, Katie Harris, and Courtney Dresser, and Doug Barber. I don't care what order we go.
We're pretty interchangeable, Madam Chair.
Okay. Oh, yes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robert Dimmig. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Office of Rural Health, and I'm here to support Senate Bill 178 today. The Rural Practitioner Tax Credit was created by the legislature back in 1989 and began with the 1990 tax year. It is a credit for up to $5,000 against a personal income tax for a health care provider who practices in rural Oregon. It is administered by the Oregon Office of Rural Health. We receive applications and determine eligibility and then pass those names on to the Department of Revenue. Eligible professions are physicians, physician assistants, nurse practitioners, certified registered nurse anesthetists, podiatrists, and dentists. Eligibility requirements differ from one profession to another, but all must practice in rural Oregon at least half time. This tax credit is one of the few tools that we have available to attract providers to rural communities and is one of our stronger retention tools as well. I've included some information in my testimony about a survey that we did of those providers back in 2012. We haven't done it since, talking and giving you a little feedback on the importance to them and how they consider the tax credit as something that helps them remain in rural communities. During the 2015 legislative session, there were some changes that were made to the tax credit. The first change was the implementation of three different tiers, a 10 to 20 mile, which could get a credit for up to $3,000, 20 to 50 miles, a credit up to $4,000, and a 50 plus miles for a credit of up to $5,000. The second change is all eligible practitioners, previously it was just MD, DOs, and PAs, must attest to being willing throughout the tax year to serve patients with Medicare and Medicaid coverage. The practitioner must accept patients insured by Medicare and Medicaid up until his or her patient panel reaches a threshold of 20% with Medicare and 15% with Medicaid, or the same percentage as the county population, whichever is less. We know that the impact of these changes on the program, we don't really know the impact quite yet on all of these changes, since we are just going through the 2016 tax year now and the applications are coming in. So we should hopefully by the end of the summer or early fall have a better idea of what that impact has been. We support Senate Bill 178, and I'm happy to answer any questions. I would say I've added two maps to your testimony. One shows you the distribution of the tax credits throughout the state, and the other is to give you an idea of what those three tiers do as far as communities across the state.
Chair Massey Anderson, members of the committee, Courtney Dresser with the Oregon Medical Association, here in support of Senate Bill 178. We see that this program is very useful for our rural providers and our rural communities to recruit and retain providers in those areas. As members of the Oregon Rural Health Association, the OMA is particularly interested in creating a healthy and vibrant workforce in the rural parts of our state. I had the opportunity to, during the interim, visit many of these rural communities through listening sessions that the Oregon Health Authority conducted throughout rural Oregon throughout the summer, spring, summer, fall, and really had an opportunity to hear from the community members themselves, the providers in those communities. And these programs are important, and this program is important, and we do hope that the legislature will continue to keep this credit active for our rural providers. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and other members of the committee. My name is Katie Harris. I'm the Director of Program Management for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. I'm also a board member for the Oregon Rural Health Association. In my role with the Hospital Association, I primarily work with Oregon's 32 Type A and Type B small and rural hospitals. On behalf of Oregon's 32 Type A and Type B hospitals and the patients that they serve, the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems appreciates the opportunity to comment on Senate Bill 178. Oregon's hospitals support this legislation, which, if extended, would continue to provide an important tool for hospitals to recruit and retain healthcare providers in their community. Rural Oregon is in a dire primary care shortage, provider shortage, and this tax credit for rural medical care is an essential incentive for physicians, nurse practitioners, and physician's assistants and others to come to and stay in rural Oregon. Both the Lewin Group report and the listening sessions in summer 2016, which were conducted under the direction of the Oregon Health Policy Board to evaluate the value of these programs, showed that the rural provider tax credit positively impacts the number of providers in rural Oregon. The Healthcare Workforce Committee said that the tax credits, quote, have a sizable retention effect on eligible providers, end quote. It is imperative that this tax credit not be allowed to sunset at the end of 2017 and instead be extended until 2024. We hope you will join us in supporting this bill. Thank you.
Questions? We've heard this, it seems like, every 2 years, when I thought it was supposed to be every 6 years. And I think that since we made some changes last time, that let's wait to see what the data is. any comments? Okay.
I think that's a good, I like that thought, Senator. Okay.
Doug Barber, thank you very much.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, Doug Barber here on behalf of the Oregon Rural Health Association. You're right, Senator Mona Sanderson. This is the third session in a row that we've been back with the same tax credit. It does feel like Groundhog Day and or full employment for lobbyists, one or the other. But let me just add one thing to what the other folks mentioned in their testimony. Last session, as Bob said, the Tax Credits Committee chose to implement this new tiering system for this tax credit. And legislative revenue estimates that that's a $2.2 million reduction in this tax credit. So it's a 15% cut in the credit. So we realize that The budget committees are facing some significant challenges this session. That'll carry over to the tax credits committee. One of the difficulties of having a tax credit that's up every session is that it gets whacked every session, you know, or at least there's the potential there. It would be really great if we could get a could see what the real impact of the tiering was on the providers on the credit this time, and get a six-year sunset so that we don't keep doing this over and over again. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 178 and open a work session on Senate Bill 178.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 178 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and request the bill be referred to the Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 178 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a
subsequent
referral to the Committee on Tax Credits. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Beyer?
Aye.
Senator
Crowe?
Aye.
Senator
Steiner?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 178. And colleagues,
do you want to open a work session?
We are going to open a work session for introduction of committee measures.
Madam Chair, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 541, dated 7/7/2016, LC 1686, dated 2/9/2017, and LC 4030, dated 2/13/2017.
Vice Chair Cruz moves the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 541, dated 7/7/2016, LC 1686, dated 2/9/2017, and LC 4030, dated 2/13/2017. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered. I will close the work session on introduction of committee measures. Happy Valentine's Day.
Madam Chair, yes. I want to thank you for the sweethearts, but you might want to consider getting a refund because some of the printing on them is hard to read.
I'm so sorry.
Those of you who are chronologically challenged.
Oh, I can challenge you on some of these.
I'm sure they are. Colleagues, I hope that most of you will be able to attend this Friday the House and Senate Health Care Committee's joint session at the Salem Convention Center to attend What Works in Public Safety. This year's conference is exploring drug law and drug policy, and the topics include health and criminal justice responses to drug addiction and the impact of collateral consequences of felony convictions. Also, local and national experts will present science of drug addiction, facts on drug use, and cutting-edge laws and policies in response to addiction and drug. And the conference is open to all of us, policymakers, criminal justice leaders, and public safety. They say they would really like us to be there, I think at 9:15 would be most pertinent to us, and you can stay as long as you want.
On Friday,
9:15 at the Salem Convention Center.
In that case, we'll rearrange our meeting, okay?
No, we can still have a meeting.
Okay.
Okay. We are adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. 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 Thank you.